The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. And it was nice to come and sit with you all. It's a custom that in January, beginning of every year, I'll give a talk on the Four Noble Truths, kind of start the year. The Four Noble Truths are considered the heart of the realization that the Buddha had. The thing that made him awake, someone who's awakened, was to have this deep insight into what he then articulated as the Four Noble Truths. And it's been said that all of Buddhism is in somehow or other comes out of that understanding, or is an expansion or rewording of these four insights that the Buddha had, four interlocking insights. And they're called truths, which for some people puts them off right away because it can seem like a creed you have to believe in. But these are meant to be pragmatic truths that we experience for ourselves, truths that are true, in their application. So it's true, I think, generally, that if you clean a wound, the wound heals quicker. That's not a, you know, it's not a big philosophical religious truth. It's just, you know, part of generally what it takes to clean, you know, to help a wound heal. So it's that kind of pragmatic aspect that these truths. And likening it to a wound is, I did because the first noble truth has to do with the wounds of being a human being. Not the physical wounds, but the kind of deep psychological or spiritual or existential wounds that people encounter. So the first one, the first truth, is the truth of suffering. And you don't have to look very far in this human world of ours to encounter some form of suffering. There's suffering on the small scale, and there's suffering on large existential scale. So in a couple of weeks, there's going to be a workshop here on exploring death and dying. You know, that's a place where there can be a lot of suffering. And then there's a truth of what causes that suffering, what causes the wound that people experience, they carry with them. And then there's the possibility of the cure, possibility of healing that wound in some way. And then there's the cure, the cleaning the wound, keeping it covered, putting the antibiotics on, sewing it up, whatever it takes. And this is what the Buddha called the Eightfold Path. So the first of these, the first truth of suffering, explicitly does not say, implicitly does not say that life is suffering, but rather says that there is suffering in this life of ours. And Buddhists will use the word suffering a lot, and the question is, what does it mean? It's sometimes used so often that we kind of glaze over when we hear the word. And one of the meanings, I like to see that it kind of, that when the Buddha described what is suffering, what is the first noble truth, he divided it into two general categories of suffering. One is the large sufferings. Buddha said that birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, and dying is suffering. And so if you happen to go through one of those, you'll often, many people experience a lot of disruption, disintegration of the structure of their life as they are deeply sick, strong disintegration of their life, and the structures of what holds their life together, what gives their life meaning and worth, falls apart when some people get sick, when they get old, as they're dying. And that that disintegration of the different elements that create a whole for what our life is about, our community, our sense of connection to others, sense of connection to ourselves, understanding of who we are in this world, is a very powerful form of suffering for people. So that's one whole category. The other category can be seen as both big suffering but also smaller suffering. The Buddha defined as one of the things he said was not getting what you want is suffering for some of us. And then there's being separated from what you love, from your loved ones or different things, and then being connected or in contact with things you dislike. So even small children, suffer because they don't get what they want. But some of the adults kind of sometimes will even, not take them so seriously for some of their suffering, because it's just, what do you mean? You're upset because you can't have the third candy. But this idea of not getting what we want operates, even some of you coming here today, maybe you didn't get the parking space you were hoping for, or the seat in the hall that you were hoping for. And so there's some disruption, some agitation, some frustration, some annoyance, some sense of loss, something goes on there. And then reviewing your life, which apparently some of you will do here in a couple of weeks on Saturday, the workshop, end of your life. Maybe you didn't get to do in your life what you most wanted. Some people followed a course of life that was set in motion by their parents and their society, and went to certain schools, did certain careers, and come to the end of their life and realize, I didn't do what I really wanted. And that's a huge realization, to realize that, the end of one's life. So to look at this first noble truth is one of the important tasks of Buddhist practice. And it's one of the reasons why some people are delighted by Buddhism and why some people recoil from it. And the people who are delighted, kind of sometimes you have the experience, people kind of hear the Four Noble Truths for the first time and they say, wow, someone's finally saying it like it is. Someone's finally talking about this, which I've intuited or felt is going on in our society and my family and me. But everyone else has been denying it. Everyone else is kind of prettying it up and, trying to say it's going to be okay or have solutions to it all rather than looking at it directly. The people who recoil are sometimes the people who feel like it's, it's kind of depressing to talk about suffering. You should, at all costs, you should avoid looking at it, and you should pretend that it's not there. You should have a religious or spiritual or whatever philosophy which creates a beautiful, inspiring vision of what life is. It's all pastoral and nice and rainbows everywhere. And meditation centers should have pastel colors. And we should all kind of probably play music Sunday morning here so that we could all kind of be distracted from, our suffering. So that's, so both options go on, but a very important aspect of Buddhist practice is a willingness to stop and look and understand and investigate the nature of our suffering. One of the things I do is I'm involved in a training program for Buddhist chaplains. And chaplains are people who visit others at times when their life is ruptured in dramatic ways. Their life is, as they know it, has disintegrated. Life as they know it has kind of come apart. So this idea of the normal structures of their life, the normal ways in which they get meaning and connection to themselves and the world around them, no longer works. And it's quite challenging for some people. So, for example, being hospitalized is quite a challenge, especially if it's a real serious illness and you're there for a long time. And you can't, your role as a breadwinner of a family, your role as a certain career, your role as a parent, your role in society no longer is there. You're just there in a kind of a sleeping gown that's open in the back. And and your kind of dignity and worth, is, I visited a man who's dying on Thursday at the Zen Hospice, 95-year-old man. And one of the things that he was kind of a little bit upset about was the indignity of having to put on diapers and having the nurses come in and move his private parts around, clean them up. It was kind of upsetting for him to have that happen at the end of his life. This is what it comes to. So there's chaplains look at people in hospitals, you know, sick, seriously sick. Also sometimes in hospice, like I was this last week, people who are dying, which is a big disruption for many people. And some people, there's one woman in our training program who's doing hospice work for homeless people. She goes around with other chaplains and does kind of chaplaincy spiritual programs for people who are homeless. And that's another dramatic disruption for many of them. So it's interesting to look at what chaplains look for when they come in to see a patient or see a homeless person, what they're tuning into, because chaplains are tuning into suffering. And so how are they trying to understand suffering or looking at it? And there are three, some chaplains will look at three primary areas in which they will try to understand their suffering, understand suffering. One is from the point of view of a person's value and worth. How a person experiences their own value and sense of worth as a person. The second is how they experience a meaning for their life and what they do. And the third has to do with what issues of reconciliation, of forgiveness, what relationships need to be healed in order to become whole again. And so the idea of worth, of value, is sometimes referred to in chaplaincy world as dignity, that everyone has a sense of dignity or feels that they're worthwhile or worthy or have value as a human being. And, you know, maybe some of you feel that automatically, easily. But there are plenty of people who don't feel this in our society. Society actually will tell them that you're not really worthwhile, you don't really count in some way, you're put aside. I was struck reading the paper this morning that 9 years before I was born in 1954, it was only 9 years before I was born that America ended its immigration law for the Chinese exclusion law, what was it called? The Chinese Exclusion. So Chinese Exclusion Act, 9 years before I was born. So that's pretty recent, right? And, people of Chinese origin coming to America were not allowed to become citizens. And it's a little bit touching for me, particularly because I'm an immigrant myself. I wasn't born here. I came here as an immigrant. And so other people came here and were excluded. And so, you don't count. You can't really count and be worthy like us, is what that one of the messages of that. And now we have, all kinds of attempts to, in California and around the country, to care for, to cut the budgets. And so some of the places that are being cut are people who are the most underserved people in our society. And for some of those people, I'm sure, part of the message they get as Medicare, Medi-Cal gets cut out from underneath them a little bit, is you don't really count, you're not really worthwhile. And so their sense of dignity and worth are not really, it's hard to maintain it in those situations. The idea of meaning, of value and worth is often connected to being part of a community. So being a community of maybe friends, family, your local neighborhood, your religious group, your church perhaps. There's all kinds of ways people get community. And so is that community, so chaplains will go into the hospital and say, is the person connected to a community? Or has that relationship been ruptured? Because sometimes it gets ruptured in dramatic ways in times of big illness. So if someone's been ill for a long time, after a while, the community starts falling off, and people stop seeing them. Or maybe they don't have community. Some people's relationships to community has been ruptured for much of their life, and that involves a certain degree of pain and suffering. Can people have a sense of part of what the sense of worth and value is having a possibility and opportunity to be of service, to serve others, to love other people? And does a person have that opportunity? So again, when there's major disruptions in people's lives, and to be of service, they can't really fall through and do that. So life is suffering, the Buddha said. I mean, he said life is suffering. There is suffering in life. And so some of that can come with our sense of lack of sense of that we're valuable, we're important. And how do you restore that for a person? How do you help a person understand that they are a valuable person? How do you impart a person's sense of deep acceptance and love for them? And so a chaplain is one person in the hospital whose kind of job description is to try to do that. The surgeon isn't trying to do that necessarily, or the nurses aren't trying to do that, but the chaplain is one person who tries to meet a person and show with their presence, their caring, their kindness, that they are really important. The second area of that a chaplain looks at is the idea of meaning. Does a person's life have meaning? Does the stories and what they experience, does their illness, does it fit into some purpose or some larger scheme or some understanding, scheme of understanding, so that it's not just seen as being valueless or unimportant or not leading to something, not opening to some possibility? And so some people, it's the life of the story of their life, which is very valuable to have someone listen to. It's meaningful for some people as they're dying or very sick to have someone who listens to some of the important stories of their life, maybe the stories that are incomplete or the stories which are still have an open wound in them. And actually to have someone witness a story, there's something about that it's meaningful to someone else to hear and listen. It helps to heal some wound for some people. And so chaplains do that. They listen to stories, and they listen with attention and care and interest. But also, does it have meaning? Does it have meaning that you're sick? Does it have meaning that someone you knew died? Does it have meaning that you're dying? Does it have meaning that you lost your job? Does it have meaning that, you had some kind of rupture in your life? And you find that a lot of people are looking for meaning. This means that God, it's the will of God that puts meaning in it. This means it's my past karma. Something settles when people have some sense that it fits a pattern or they have an understanding for it. So the third thing has to do with reconciliation or forgiveness or how to heal relationships. And it's quite, I think, interesting that when people, as they're dying, or some people in times of crisis, that it's hard to die unless they kind of resolve or bring to a conclusion or finish or say something to someone else they're in relationship with. They might have managed for decades to let it kind of be in the back burner and even think it's not so important. But it's interesting what comes up to the forefront of a person's life as they're dying, what's unresolved, what needs to be finished. And sometimes it's asking forgiveness from someone else, saying, I'm sorry for something I did. Sometimes it's offering forgiveness and say, I forgive you. Or sometimes just saying that I love you in a way that maybe has never been said before. Or sometimes it's forgiving oneself, because that's where the relationship that's ruptured, relationship to oneself, one's own sense of value or worth, because of what one has done. So how do you forgive oneself? So all these things have to do with places where people's lives are somehow broken or disintegrated or ruptured. And so how do we understand our suffering? And then how do we address it? Certainly you could, there are things you can do in the world that you might, if you're successful, people will praise you. And you could get more sense of value and importance. You can get elected as governor of California. And I'm sure that makes you feel like you're important and valuable. But that's probably not going to happen to most of us. But there's other things you can do. You can, things you can do. Or a sense of meaning, you could take philosophy class. You could read some great spiritual books and kind of pull in their sense of meaning and adopt it and say, yes, now I have a real sense of meaning. And there are people who really latch on very strongly to given meaning, to kind of borrowed meaning from religions, from other people. I remember when I was at the San Francisco Zen Center in the 70s, there was a teacher there who was brilliant and giving us the sense that Zen Buddhism and the San Francisco Zen Center was at the cutting edge of whatever good was going to happen in the world. And he would know all these great political figures and the governor of California, and he would tell these Dharma talks where you felt like, you know, the big change in society was going to happen right here, right there, and we were kind of sharing the meaning in it. And it felt like very meaningful to be connected. It was so meaningful that I remember when I told my mother that the governor of California would come visit the abbot, she said, "Oh, it's okay that you're studying Zen then." And I remember how, you know, kind of certain kind of euphoria or mild euphoria I'd feel by feeling kind of this sense of meaning and purpose that, you know, that these stories that Abbot told us about. So borrowed meaning. So then we come to the second noble truth, which from the Buddhist analysis of what's the cause of suffering. And here, this is very interesting because it gives a certain spin or angle from which, perspective in which to look at all these other issues, or earlier issues I talked about. And so in shorthand, the Buddha said suffering is caused by craving. So then we look at, where is there craving involved in any of these disruptions, any of these things? So for example, meaning, to take one example. It could seem that meaning is a good thing to have. And people will ask, you know, I'd like to have, you know, what's the meaning of life? I'm looking for the meaning of life. I'm looking for the meaning of my life. I'm looking for the meaning in, you know, what happens to me. I'm unemployed, and I want to, you know, it's important to me to find meaning in that and value in that. And so what's the meaning in being unemployed? Maybe I need to learn something new. Maybe I need to, whatever. So in asking us to look at craving, Buddhism, in a sense, is asking us to do something which is to turn around 180 degrees and turn the attention towards what motivates us to want meaning. What is the motivation for it? Rather than assuming that the search for meaning is worthwhile, and so because we're searching, we're looking out towards meaning, trying to understand it. We look around and see what motivates that search. What are the emotions that are motivating it? What's the anxiety? What's the desires connected to it? What are the beliefs connected to the search for meaning? And so, from the point of the second noble truth, is there craving connected to that search of meaning? Is there some kind of compulsion? Is there some kind of drive in the search for meaning which comes from motivations which are best settled for themselves, better resolved on their own before we search for meaning? So, for example, if a search for meaning is driven by fear, it's probably better to turn around and resolve the fear than it is to find the meaning. Because if you find meaning, then chances are that the anxiety that prompted you to find it to begin with stays unresolved. The fact that you now know what your life is all about doesn't necessarily settle the deeper wound, the deeper anxiety or emptiness that prompted it to begin with. So this idea of turning 180 degrees around and looking at what is the compulsion, the drive, the motivation, is part of this looking for craving itself. So also the sense of dignity and worth. Is there some kind of compulsion or craving connected to the search for dignity or sense of value or self-worth? Often can be. Because as soon as you talk about worth and dignity and self-value, it connects to a tremendous, complex field of self, self-definition, self-identity, ideas we have about who I am in relationship to other people. And many times these ideas of identity are unexamined. And so to simply say, oh, you should have a strong sense of self-worth, is this too simplistic to say without if you think of self-worth as being like a coat you put on, maybe you need to understand what coat rack you're putting it on, or what body you're putting it on, what belief systems you're putting it on. So there might be, you might have grown up in a family where your parents told you, you know, basically you got the message that only if you succeed in particular areas of life will you be a worthwhile person. And so rather than finding your worth through that pursuit, it might be more interesting to turn around 180 degrees and look deeply at what is driving you for that pursuit of success in certain fields. And it might, you might go back into your psyche to see that at the heart of it, there might be some feeling of emptiness, anxiety, that stems from maybe an anxiety that your parents had about what it means to be successful and not successful. Some part of you that's unresolved and empty. And rather than filling that empty with a particular form of external success, what happens if you turn around and have your attention, your mindfulness, look right deeply at the heart of the wound, right deeply at the heart of that emptiness or the heart of that anxiety that might be there, that prevents you from feeling some kind of sense of worth or value in and of yourself. And it's so powerful, the practice of mindfulness, to sit still and quiet and to turn around and really sit with what's deep inside and not try to fix it, not try to fill it, not try to explain it, not try to defend it, but sit there and really feel in a deep way and see what happens. And more often than not, if you can do it in a deep, mindful way, something shifts and changes by itself inside. And some kind of peace arises, some kind of sense of well-being can happen, some sense of being whole and complete, where in many ways you could say the life becomes worthwhile, valuable, but if you feel our value and our worth independent of having to do something. Because the need to find value, when there's a neediness to find value, a compulsion to find value in oneself, that itself arises out of some wound. And so to turn around and look at that in a deep way is what the call of the second noble truth is, to see what that might be. Now, the second noble truth says that that craving, something about craving or clinging or compulsion, drivenness means you can't put it down. You're kind of driven to do something. Compulsion means you have no choice but to act or to feel or believe certain things. Maybe all of you are good adults, and so you have plenty of impulse control, and so you know you're able to not physically do things that you shouldn't be doing, but it's something else about feeling and thinking. And so our deeper suffering tends to come from how we feel and think and deeper things. And some of you can see in meditation how strong the compulsion is, because it's so hard to let go of your thoughts. So the second noble truth is to look at this, because this compulsion, these cravings, is the cause of suffering. And to look at it and understand it deeply enough and to find a shift, a change, a settling, a relaxing, a letting go within us, so that we can free ourselves from those compulsions, free ourselves from those cravings. And if you sit really still and quiet enough and go deep enough in yourself, it's remarkable how you can get down to the root of what drives the need for value, the need for meaning, and shift something so that maybe the need is still there, but our peace and our well-being is not dependent on it. Or to say it a different way, if craving is the cause of suffering, when craving is let go of, then suffering won't arise. The formulation for the Four Noble Truths has no pronouns in the formulation. It doesn't say you or me. I suffer. It's my craving. or it's your suffering, it's your craving. It just says the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, and the truth of the end of suffering. And one of the meaning implications of this is that if a person is able to end craving, and all the different ways in which craving or clinging or grasping or compulsion operate, then that person won't cause any more harm, a person won't cause any more suffering to themselves and also to other people. And I think that's one of the really remarkable things about doing this practice, is to become a kind of person that there's nothing in you which is going to cause suffering in the world. Even if you don't want to cause suffering, even if you don't believe that you need to overcome your own suffering, to be a kind of person who doesn't cause suffering, you yourself are not an agent that can cause suffering with others. Because suffering has its genesis in craving. Others might suffer because of their craving, but they're not going to suffer because of your craving. And so one of the descriptions of someone who is matured and realized in these Four Noble Truths is that they offer the gift to the world, the gift of harmlessness. And I think that's such a beautiful thing, the gift of harmlessness. So meaning, value, and reconciliation are three important areas that you can kind of look at this thing about the First Noble Truths. For Buddhists, there's tremendous meaning and purpose in the path and the practice of overcoming, of freeing ourselves, of healing these wounds, healing ourselves of suffering. And so if we come into situations like we're dying or in serious illness or unemployed or all kinds of ways in which our structures of our life have fallen apart and difficult for us, for Buddhists, there's always meaning right there. Let's look at this. Let's practice with this. Let's investigate deeply in this. To be a Buddhist practitioner means you stop complaining. You know that? There's no reason to complain because you're willing to take it on and look at it. You know, what is my craving? What's my clinging? What am I attached to? Where's the freedom here? How do I cultivate love in this situation? How do I cultivate compassion? How do I cultivate peace? And there's always something to do, even right up until the time we die. So that gives tremendous meaning for some people. It also gives tremendous value. To be a person who has freed themselves from the need for self-identity creates paradoxically, a kind of identity of someone who has tremendous dignity. So much so that in the Buddhist tradition, such a person is called a noble person. So it's kind of a paradox, right? So Buddhism, I think, is pointing towards, and insists that each person has tremendous value in and of themselves, and that that value can be actualized, that value can be supported, that value can be fully confirmed through a very deep letting go of the forces of fear, the forces of hate, the forces of greed, clinging, that somehow keep us agitated and keep us unsettled on ourselves, keep us looking beyond ourselves, keeps us feeling that we're not good enough and not. And then the third, reconciliation or forgiveness, a huge part of Buddhist practice has to do about establishing healthy relationships with everyone around us. And without that creation of a healthy community, healthy relationship, healthy friendships, it's probably very difficult to do much work, deep work in Buddhist practice. So from my point of view, Buddhist practice is one of the beautiful vehicles through which a person can experience great value and worth, a great meaning for their life, and whatever healing needs to happen in our community, in our relationships. So Buddhism teaches there's suffering. The cause of suffering is craving. And the good news is that it's possible to end that craving and thereby end that suffering. And since it's not so easy to do that, there's a steady, somewhat methodical, careful approach to engage in that process, which is called walking the Eightfold Path. And that's what many of us will try to do this year. May each of you, during this coming year, have your disrupted life healed through turning around 180 degrees and looking deeply into your own heart and finding peace and love there. So, thank you.